Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Greetings. You're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute and a member of the Christians for Liberty Network. My guest today is Reverend Dr. Munther Isaac. Dr. Isaac is a Palestinian Christian pastor and theologian. He now pastors Hope Evangelical Lutheran Church in Ramallah. Is it Ramallah or Ramallah?
Ramallah, yes.
Ramallah, okay, good. Having previously pastored the Evangelical Lutheran Christmas Church in Bethlehem and the Lutheran Church in Beit Sahur. Did I say that one correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, I've done a little bit of Hebrew, so that one seemed familiar. Okay, he's also the director of Bethlehem Institute for Peace and Justice at Bethlehem Bible College, and is the director of the Christ at the Checkpoint Conferences. And I always like to do a short intro, but there's a number of things we should mention here. So I'll start with in your bio. So following Israel's reaction to October 7th in Gaza, Dr. Isaac gained global attention for his sermon, Christ Under the Rubble. It was heard by tens of millions of people and subsequently quoted in South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. He's appeared on CNN, BBC, Al Jazeera, MSNBC, CBS, TRT, and Democracy Now! Dr. Isaac originally studied civil engineering in Birzeit University in Palestine. He then obtained a Master in Biblical Studies from Westminster Theological Seminary and then a PhD from the Oxford Center for Mission Studies, where he also completed a dissertation on the biblical theology of the Promised Land, which that's going to come up. So, Dr. Isaac, welcome to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, and thank you for making time to talk with us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's you know, even though I've already given kind of a lengthy bio, let's start with your personal story. You know, what was it like growing up as in Palestine as a Christian?
Well, like all Palestinians, my generation, we grew up at the time of what's known as the First Intifada. As a child, my memories is with the Israeli military occupation to our towns. Right now, we have a Palestinian Authority, but we're still occupied. But back then, the Israeli military was everywhere, all the time, in our faces, in our neighborhoods. And then there were several demonstrations, regular demonstrations, I would say. And I remember, you know, the shooting, the tear gas, the strikes, the soldiers going home to home looking for Palestinians who used to throw rocks at Israeli soldiers. This was the time of the Palestinian nonviolent intifada from 1987, let's say, to 1991 or so. And to me, this shaped, of course, everything. My childhood, interrupted school time, homeschooling for us in the neighborhoods. Lots of curfews where we could not leave the house, but also interrupted church gatherings. So it also forced us to think at an early age of questions related to the Bible and so on. So that's my childhood. Even then when I grew up and I became a student in university, that's when the second intifada happened, the second uprising, more violent, marked with so much bombing, suicide attacks from the Palestinian side, Israel bombing Palestinian towns and cities, invading with tanks, destroying the whole infrastructure of our cities. So these violent clashes also, you know, as much troubling they were and dangerous to our lives, but also shaped a lot of who I am today.
Well, and you mentioned so some who are maybe not as fully aware of all this history, that in at least sounds like the earlier part of that first intifada was largely nonviolent. Is that correct?
Yes. Listen, Cody, the majority of Palestinian resistance to the Israeli occupation over the years has been nonviolent. The world seems to be fixated on Palestine when there is violence. Yet, for years, Palestinians tried nonviolence, most especially in this first intifada, which was a time of popular ground, grassroots resistance, strikes, civil disobedience. In my town of Beit Sahur, we stopped paying taxes to the Israeli military, saying no taxation without representation. You know, with everyone now talking about Gaza, especially in the last 2 years, what shocks me is that not much is mentioned about the fact that the people of Gaza themselves tried nonviolence. For a whole year, they demonstrated nonviolently, trying to break the siege. The inhumane siege that they suffered from years, for 16 years before October 7th, but prior to that, they tried nonviolence, and they were definitely, obviously, met with Israeli violence. Many were killed, many were shot by snipers. In other words, yes, Palestinians tried nonviolence, but that, unfortunately, didn't work because Israel enjoys the support of the international community. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think for someone outside of, you know, Israel-Palestine, you know, I sort of grew up sort of hearing like, well, you know, Israel's doing a lot of bad things, but, you know, what can you do? You've got radical Muslims, you've got suicide bombers, they're in a really tough spot. And so there was this sort of sense in which I think a lot of people in the West kind of hearing that narrative sort of throw up their hands and they say, well, you know, I don't know, what are you going to do? It's a tough situation. And but as you're noting, you know, Israel had an aggressive, violent response even to nonviolent activism.
Yeah, not only that, if everyone keeps pointing to radical Islamic groups, let's not forget that none of that existed in 1948 when Israel was created on Palestinian land and when the Zionist militias displaced more than 700, close to 800,000 Palestinians, forcibly removed them from the land and then destroyed the villages and built the state on the ruins of our towns and villages. That wasn't a fight against radical Islam. That was, you know, the Zionists coming to our land, displacing us to build a state for their own. Similarly, 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza, definitely there was no radical Islam, the first Intifada. So all these years of Israelis' occupation and displacement of Palestinians were long before Hamas was even in existence. And what we're seeing, for example, today with radical settlers attacking villages, spreading terror, attacking civilians, killing them sometimes in their homes, has nothing to do with Israel fighting radical Islam. I think that's always some way of shifting the blame and controlling the narrative, making everything about Israel fighting radical Islam or Islamic terrorism, and it distorts the real situation on the ground. And it's part of who controls the narrative. You know, a lot of times, my experience, if only people knew what's really happening on the ground, if only people just take some time to read history or even just come and spend 3 or 4 days in our land, and then your whole perspective will change completely once you know really what's happening on the ground.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the radical settlers, people from Israel who are pushing Palestinians out of their homes and taking over. And sometimes people will, you'll hear stories about IDF soldiers, you know, committing atrocities and what you'll sort of hear is like, well, you know, these are anomalies, right? This is not really, you know, what the state of Israel is supporting. They don't support these kind of violent acts. So when it comes to things like the settlers that are coming in and taking people's homes, do they enjoy the support of the Israeli state, or does the Israeli state just kind of say, oh, it's not really our affair, or how does that work?
First of all, we're not talking about few individuals. We're talking about organized groups. We think they are in the thousands. So let's be clear. And these are the product of certain schools, religious schools that train them, that brainwash them, that educate them into this. So they are not simply, you know, random actors, but they are the product of schools of thoughts that exist under the auspices of the Israeli government and the settler movement. So we're dealing with an ideological issue. Second, and not small numbers. Second, I think it goes way beyond the Israeli military providing protection to the settlers, because the settler serves the purpose of the Israeli state, the current Israeli government. If Israel wants to stop the settlers, Cody, they can stop them immediately. They can stop them today. If they have the desire and the intent to stop settlers' attack, they can do it immediately. Our experience is that they are enabling them, they are protecting them. In one story that, you know, I know the people involved in that story. When the settlers attacked a Palestinian family, they attacked an older woman, beat her to the ground. Her son wanted to defend her and he pushed the settlers. He fought with them to push them out of their land. When the Israeli military finally came to the scene, they came to arrest the Palestinian man who defended his wife, his mother. And he was actually in the hospital because she was an intensive care unit. So the Israeli military not only protects the settlers, but enables their protection and sends a very clear message to the Palestinians. If you try to defend your lands or your families when the settlers attack, you will be targeted, you will be arrested, you will be in some cases even shot at. So this is not the problem merely of the settlers. It's the system, it's the government, it's the military. They're all coming together with the idea, let's make life so difficult for Palestinians so that they leave. The Israelis are saying, the leaders, voluntary immigration. Let's make life so difficult so that Palestinians decide to leave.
So it's a steady effort to try to push people out. So, you know, I don't want to make you sort of be a, sort of a remedial history teacher on the Middle East, but just so we can kind of clarify what we're talking about here, the territory that we call Palestine today is essentially Gaza and the West Bank. Is that correct, these two areas? And does the State of Israel have different relationships with these two areas? It seems certainly with Gaza in the last few years, that's changed, right?
So this is a very complicated question because there is what we call historic Palestine, the whole land. Palestine under the British mandate. And that land, Palestine under the British mandate, was divided in 1948 when Israel occupied almost 78% of it, with the exception of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. That 78% became what is now known as Israel, the State of Israel. However, the State of Israel never defines its borders. That's why over the years, Israel keeps expanding. I'm not sure you know that Israel as a state is maybe one of the only states in the world that in recent history kept expanding its border to the north, in the Golan Heights, and then gradually they're trying to annex the West Bank, meaning changing the West Bank from occupied territory and Gaza from occupied territory into parts of the State of Israel. And Israel has been building settlements or colonies inside the West Bank and Gaza on land stolen from Palestinians, confiscated by force or by some rules that say if you can't prove you live in the land, you no longer can take it. And of course, the owners of the land were forcibly released. So they come and push you out of the land and then say, if you can't come back and prove your ownership of the land, then the state will take it. And that's what they do in the West Bank, for example. So they created laws to enable them to steal land. They built settlements inside. And now Israel controls the majority of the West Bank. And they left us with condensed pockets as Palestinians. Every city is a condensed pocket in itself with gates around it. And Israel has settlers who live in the West Bank who are part of the government. So to them, that's part of Israel, the West Bank. And now they reoccupied the majority of Gaza, of the Gaza Strip, of having, you know, pushed the majority of people to the south, and they control the majority of that land. And we hear their politicians clearly stating that we should not leave and just annex it, maybe consider it part of the state of Israel. Now, when Palestinians say we want a state of our own, Palestinians clearly mean we want a state in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, because East Jerusalem was only occupied in 1967. The two-state solution. But the two-state solution is becoming almost impossible. It is actually, by most political analysts, dead because of the building of these settlements inside the West Bank. So you can't have a state or sovereignty for Palestinians with just unconnected pockets surrounded by the State of Israel. That doesn't make any sense. And that's why we're right now in a moment when no one knows what the future holds for Palestinians. So you have the State of Israel that's in control with the vast majority of the land, subjugates the Palestinians to different rule, that of military rule. But the number of Palestinians and Israelis after all these years is almost the same, 7 million Palestinians and 7 million Israeli Jews. So what are you going to do with that? You can't continue to oppress and impose a military rule on millions of people.
Well, I want to get back to some of that stuff, but I also, there's still some kind of personal biographical stuff I want to clear up. So those people can see your clerical collar. what made you want to become a pastor? Was it something you always wanted to do, or did it sort of come to you? Because you went to school not to do that originally, but to be an engineer, right?
Yeah, I wanted to be an engineer, but I've always been devout. I've always been close to the church. I considered studying theology at a young age. No one encouraged me. People thought I would be wasting my life. Even when I decided to study theology after I finished my engineering degree, people thought I'm wasting my life. To me, it's a calling. It's definitely a calling. And a lot of that is a call to serve my people. Mm. I've seen so much pain in my life, pain around us, pain that breaks you. People respond to injustice in different ways. Sadly, some people turn to violence and vengeance. Some people turn to politics. Some people turn to education. Some people turn to nonviolence. And my response was, I want to serve by studying theology and work with the church or any other ministry. And that's what, you know, when I finished my degree at the time of the Second Intifada and was really battling with questions related to how to respond to the constant humiliation at checkpoints. How do I convince my people that violence doesn't bring us liberation? It can be, you know, that, you know, we can't, if we are against killing civilians, we can't kill civilians as well. That right. Nonviolence is actually effective. And that's when I actually began getting to know the writings of Martin Luther King and his activism. You know, all of that, honestly, then inspired me to go and study theology. Honestly, not knowing that, that will lead me to engaging in so much battles with Christian Zionism on a theological level and really contributing more or helping my people more by challenging this, what we think is one of the biggest obstacles to peace in this land, namely Christian Zionism.
Well, and you know, we'll get into this a little bit, this idea of Christian Palestinians, which I think must be a real category confusion for a lot of Western Christians. But I mean, I think about this, and I appreciate your willingness to serve your people by communicating these ideas to the world and their stories. And you know, I appreciate you taking my questions as well, because I imagine at a certain point hearing these questions over and over again, it can be kind of agitating. It's like, well, you know, hey, man, this is a really horrible situation. And I feel like I have to defend, you know, my right to exist and my experience. But, you know, I wonder, you know, what it's like in particular, how frustrating it must be being a Palestinian Christian and hearing Western Christians talk about the state of Israel in such sort of glowing terms when your experience with it is so different. And, you know, your church's 2023 nativity scene, I think, was this sort of nonviolent act that got a lot of global attention. And with it was the sermon you preached called Christ in the Rubble, a Liturgy of Lament. And so I guess, you know, what is it that you were and are hoping to communicate, not just to your congregation, but to the larger Christian world that is, you know, really influenced by these ideas of Christian Zionism and, you know, Israel, my country, you know, good or bad, love it or leave it or whatever.
Yeah. It's still mind-boggling. It's still disappointing. I don't know how to just put enough words to say when you have your siblings in Christ, sisters and brothers in Christ, work directly against you, against your presence, against your existence, on all levels. We have been erased by this discourse that views Israel as central in God's plan. The Jewish people must come to Palestine. This prepares maybe the second coming of Christ. They have a special relationship with God. They can be touched. We must bless them. Mm-hmm. All of these views are not theoretical, because all of these views are built on our expense. And all of these views have led on the ground to our displacement, literal displacement. Thousands of Palestinian Christians were displaced in 1948 by force when Israel was created. And so what you have is this discourse on our ideology or theology of the Western world that prefers and supports the bringing of Jewish immigrants to our land at our expense. So they're not bringing them even as immigrants. They're bringing them to displace us as settlers, as colonials.
Yeah. To literally take your homes. Because I mean,
literally yeah, take our yeah, home. Not in a metaphorical sense. Because we still, you know, can go back to Jaffa or to what's now West Jerusalem or to Lydda or to any, you know, many places and point to homes that belong to Palestinian Christian families. And the families can't even visit them, or in some instances, they were lucky enough to go and visit them, knock on the door, and they can tell you the stories. And a Jewish person opened and said, sorry, this is now my house. So when all of this happens, not only with the support, but the blessing and financing sometimes of your siblings in Christ is shocking to us. It's you know, so we've been physically displaced. The attention of the global church has now become Israel, the Jewish people, and it's as if we don't exist. And I want you to think of the phrase, a land without people. Mm-hmm. They have turned this into a reality because the land always had people, but in actuality, how they functioned, it's as if no one is there. Or the people who are there don't worry, you know, they don't matter. We can displace them. We can push them out. It doesn't matter because in their mind, it's a land without people of equal worth, including the Palestinian Christian community, indigenous community that has kept the Christian presence in this land for almost 2,000 years. I want you to think of that. Now, our existence is now on the verge of distinction. You know, we might not exist in 20, 30 years for the first time in history. And a lot of that is supported, blessed by our so-called Christian brothers and sisters.
And it's not the result of radical Islam because you've been in the land for 2,000 years. it's the result of Israel. Yeah, well, and that language of a land without people, those who are not maybe familiar with kind of the history of this debate and this conversation or whatever, this goes back to, I don't remember the name of the British politician who initially said it, but it was this term for, so after the Holocaust, it was like, okay, the Jews are a people without a land and Israel is a land without people.
Yeah, this is before the Holocaust.
Oh, it comes before.
Way before the Holocaust, because Christian Zionism predates Jewish Zionism. Christian Zionism originated in the 19th century. Lord Shaftesbury, who's the one who said these words, a people without a country for a country without a people, or something like that, or a country without a nation. The idea then was to find a solution to the so-called, and this is their words, Jewish problem in Europe. Mm-hmm. And this continues to be part of the dilemma or the problem that we're facing, which is the fact that the rest of the world that keeps pushing and arguing for Israel's right to exist because everyone wants Jews to be safe, mm-hmm. what they're telling us is that Jews can't be safe in the United States or in Germany. That's why they have to be safe in Palestine by displacing, mm-hmm. I guess, millions of Palestinians.
It's making it your problem. Right?
So basically, that was part of it. But it was coupled with theological beliefs back then that the solution to the Jewish problem is for them to embrace Jesus as the Messiah. For that to happen, they must be physically present in the land. So the idea to encourage Jews to immigrate to Palestine originated in Christian Protestant circles, to encourage their immigration to Palestine so that they can be restored again to the family of God. And then that also, there is another element here, which is the fact that in Europe, they thought if these European Jews go to Palestine, they can actually become our extension in a time when global colonialism in its old form was beginning to end. So they thought, let's keep our people there and encourage them to establish a state of their own there. And the early Zionists, actually, when they talked to the Jewish Zionists, when they talked to the Europeans, they said, yes, we are colonizers just like you, and that's why we can work together. So the idea of bringing Jews to Palestine to serve a theological purpose actually is a Christian idea before it's a Jewish idea. The mobilization of it, the political dimension of it is also a Christian before it became a Jewish Zionist political movement. And hence the idea of a land without people, which is one of the slogans of the Zionist movement, the Jewish Zionist movements, has an earlier formation or an earlier version in British Protestant circles as well. And again, the problem with all of this is that they're talking about Palestine as if it's empty. Palestine was never empty. Palestine had people. And at the time of the Zionist movement, Palestine had people who had aspirations of their own self-determination, who were tired of being controlled by a Ottoman Empire, who sought independence and self-determination only to be colonized by England and then the Zionist movement and the creation of Israel.
Well, and you know, this is why I think libertarians in particular should be, should have some very strong feelings about Israel and Palestine, because the arguments that are being used in favor of what Israel's doing are things like states have rights, not individuals, or that individuals do not actually have a right to their own property, or these ideas like ethno-nationalism, all of these things which are, you know, I think not only contradictory to Christianity, but also very, very much contradictory to libertarian principles.
And beyond that, it's all idea of bringing a religious entitlement idea to a political discourse. I am a pastor, right? I believe the Bible. I'm actually, you know, I believe the Bible has authority over doctrine, over ethics. I mean, I'm a Bible-believing Christian. At the same time, I don't think the Bible functions as a book of land deeds. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Bible decides who owns the state or that state. That's why we as humanity create laws, regulations to govern our relationships with one another. My argument in a dispute cannot be, my God gave me the land. My argument cannot be, thousands of years ago, there was this guy and we are his descendants and God gave him the land. I mean, I'm happy to debate the theology beyond that. I've written a lot about it, but again, is the Bible the book that decides these issues? To me, the Bible is the book that gives us principles of justice, of fairness, of truth, of defending the oppressed, the marginalized, of love your neighbor, love your enemy, mercy. But it's not the book I turn to decide whether, you know, this property belongs to these people. Or, I mean, the whole idea of making it a religious concept shocks me. And the fact that this comes many times from Christians in the West who actually challenge Islamic fundamentalist views for bringing theology and politics together, they are doing the same with Israel. I mean, the irony here is hard to miss. And it shocks me that, you know, the things that Christian Zionists say about Israel, that they have divine right to the land. If Muslims use that language, you'll go, yeah, you can't say that, but you have no problem when Christians say it about Israel and the Jewish people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, there's some listening who may say, well, you know, but God said it and I believe it. So we'll want to spend a little bit of time maybe looking at those claims as we move forward. But I want to bring out a word that I've heard you use and I've heard others use, and that word is genocide. And some will say, well, that's too strong of a word. This is not like the Holocaust. This is not like, you know, certain historical examples of genocide where the point was to, you know, exterminate every person in the land. Can you explain your use of the word genocide and why you think it's an accurate word to use?
Well, we didn't write the definition of a genocide. The Palestinians didn't write the definition. We don't decide. My opinion, actually, Cody, doesn't matter. It's not something about your subjective opinion. What do you think of it? It doesn't matter what I think or, you know, what you think. It matters what the definition says and what experts who studied the situation can say about do the facts on the ground match the definition. Genocide is not about how many people were killed. Genocide has several categories, you know, the intent to kill in full or in part certain people, by creating, for example, life circumstances, not necessarily by killing every member of them. And so when you look at the definition, again, not the definition that we Palestinians wrote, and then you look at the amount of evidence, it's hard not to conclude that it's a genocide. But don't listen to me. There is today all over the world, departments in universities specialized in genocide and Holocaust. Holocaust and genocide studies. There are hundreds of scholars. They have associations. They have gatherings. They said it's a genocide. In fact, the Israeli genocide scholars themselves in the Hebrew universities, some of them said it's a genocide by the letter of the definition, by the letter, you know, when you look at the definition. Human rights experts, you know, we have organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International that are usually celebrated for their investigations, their reports, their advocacy for human rights, who have concluded it's a genocide, based again on the definition. You have the Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem. You have an organization of Israeli doctors who also said it's a genocide. You have, at the same time, numerous UN reports and UN independent studies and inquiries on the issue. So the number of reports, studies, declarations that say this is a genocide are hard to ignore. The only question then becomes, why are we not calling it a genocide? Is it because Palestinians deserve less human rights? Are we less human? Is it because, you know, you don't believe in these definitions? Then tell us, create your own definition, but don't tell us when we use the definition that international community used to describe other genocides, that when we apply it and conclude Palestinians are being genocided now, and you tell us, no, no, it doesn't work this way. To me, it's a form of racism. It's an assault on our humanity. I'm so passionate about it because on top of everything that happened to Palestinians, the displacement of 2 million people, the fact that as we speak, Cody, almost now, what, 2.5 years into the beginning of the war in Gaza on October 7th, food has not entered Gaza. You know, at least acknowledge Israel is committing war crimes because you cannot, by the international law, use starvation as a weapon of war. Israel is doing it. They're telling the world they're doing it. Even as we speak now, in June 2026, food aid has not entered Gaza in a sufficient way, in very small numbers only. And we're still debating, is it a genocide or not? Why is Israel not allowing food? Why is Israel not even allowing journalists to enter so that we know the extent of the horrific crimes that happened in Gaza? Are they afraid that, you know, we uncover more of these horrible things that happens? So to me, the real question is, why are we not calling it a genocide? Who benefits from that? Why does Israel enjoy this special treatment? When they commit war crimes, they are not held accountable. When Russia invaded Ukraine, sanctions on day one, same day. And now look at that. What's happening in Gaza, 2.5 years, nothing. In fact, those who call for sanctions are targeted. Those who try to implement the law by, you know, the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice, the judges are persecuted. The special rapporteur on Palestinian territories is being harassed and her bank accounts freeze and so on. So you get the idea here. It's not that activists are saying it's a genocide just to demonize Israel. The evidence is so clear. And the real question then becomes, why aren't the world and the rest of the world calling it a genocide? And, you know, you mentioned one of my books, Christ in the Rubble. I go in detail into the definition of a genocide. And then even when I wrote it last year, the great amount and reports, since I wrote the book, more and more evidence, more and more reports have been published to the effect that this is a genocide. And it shocks me again that Israeli Jewish scholars are saying this is a genocide, yet the rest of the world or even the church in the West is challenging us when we call it, as Palestinians, a genocide.
Well, and I think there's a lot of listeners who are going to be sympathetic to what you're saying. Actually, I presume that our program probably will have, you know, more sympathy than others, but there still could be some people who are inclined to side with Israel for various reasons. And so one reason that I'll sometimes hear, one argument that I'll often hear, is that, well, Israel is a secular democracy. It believes in free markets. It believes in gay rights. Palestine is an Islamist theocracy filled with terrorists, and they oppress Christians. They put gay people to death and throw them off roofs. And so we should just side with Israel. So what would you say to those who are making this kind of argument that civilization must win out over barbarism at any cost? And maybe to make it personal, and this is me speaking from their perspective, as a Palestinian Christian, don't you fear Islamic rulers more than secular Israelis?
Yeah. Well, secular Israelis have committed the same genocide in Gaza. They're allowing the terror, the settlers to attack villages right now. Interesting. I don't know where to begin by this, because first of all, the description itself is so full of inaccuracies. Whether Israel is a secular democracy, Israel is a Jewish state, it's built on ethno-national privilege. Go and read the nation-state law, which is part of the Israeli DNA, which says the right for self-determination is exclusive to the Jewish people. So they have Jewish supremacy in the law. Israel has been described by, I mean, there is a consensus in the human rights world and community and experts that it's an apartheid state. Apartheid is a war crime. The South Africans, actually, when they visit us, when we talk with them, they tell us what you have is far worse than the apartheid we had in terms of the discrimination. So to us, it comes across as very offensive when such things, you know, are said about it. It's so insensitive to us when you describe Israel in such a way. given how it's treating Palestinians. At the same time, the description about Palestine is also not accurate. Palestine is diverse. We have religious groups. We have secular people. We have Christians. We have Muslims. So the description on about Palestine is also not accurate. However, Cody, I'm going to just assume for the sake of argument that everything you said in the introduction and to that question is accurate. So let's just assume that, yes, Israel is the perfect democracy, secular, which is funny because Israel is now literally run by religious extremists, which is funny. You know, Israel is literally run by religious fanatics. But I'm just going to assume you're right. And that Palestine, you know, is the exact opposite. Does that mean let's go and kill Palestinians? It's okay. Is that really your moral standards? You know, I was listening recently to a conversation between, I think, Bill Maher and another pro-Palestine activist, journalist, Anna, I forgot her last name. And he was telling her, can you go with a short skirt and walk in the streets of Jordan or Lebanon or even Palestine? And, you know, I can't understand that this is someone who presents himself as a progressive liberal asking that question. So because an American woman cannot go and walk in a short skirt in the streets of Gaza, does that mean we can just bomb the hell out of Gaza? Really? That's your moral standards? And you claim to have higher moral standards than the rest of the world? So how is this relevant to our conversation? The fact that, you know, Palestine has a majority of Muslims, or that, you know, in Palestine, gay marriage is not allowed versus in Israel. You know, how is that relevant? Does that mean that Israel can be a state above the international law and kill Palestinians because they have certain worldviews that are closer to us Americans? It doesn't make any sense, friends. If we want to claim as Christians a higher moral authority, it has to be through justice, through compassion, not by eliminating others and killing them and active as if we are above any impunity or international laws or human rights as such. So again, just to answer your question, what you described is not actually accurate. At the same time, even if it was accurate, does that give to steal land, to kill people, to impose? Because I thought you were all about religious freedom. You want to impose your religious worldview on everyone else? Or I mean, again, I wish people are listening to themselves when they say these bogus things. And finally, I would like to invite you to come to Palestine. I would love for you to come. And I'm serious. Come and I'll talk you around in Ramallah and Bethlehem. Come and take you even in Hebron or Nablus. And then you tell me whether Palestinians are just these savage religious fanatics who want to kill everyone. Please come and see. I mean, these descriptions of Palestinians are so not only dehumanizing, demonizing to us. Come and learn about Palestinians, our life, our culture, and understand where does the anger we have come from. It's from years of oppression, of our rights being denied, of our people being killed. Just 2 days ago, 7-month-old infant was killed in Hebron, in the streets of Hebron by Israelis. I mean, how do you endure all these lives of oppression, of seeing children killed, of seeing thousands imprisoned? Come and understand the Palestinians rather than continuing to say these stereotypes that are so demeaning of Palestinians.
Well, I'm gonna give you another one because this is the kind of question you sometimes hear, which is, you know, some would say maybe, okay, granted a lot of what you said there, but wouldn't it just be foolish for Israel to try to make peace with Palestine, right? When groups like Hamas have already made it very clear what they want to do to Israel on October 7th. And there's an example that sometimes comes up. Thomas Jefferson made this argument about American slavery. He said that white Americans had essentially grabbed a wolf by the ear. And there was a significant danger in letting it go, meaning that if America freed its slaves, there would be this inherent danger of those freed slaves retaliating with their newfound freedom. And so, you know, Israel's in this tough spot where if they provide freedom to Palestinians, they'll be, you know, what's to stop October 7th on a massive scale from taking place. And so, I mean, doesn't that demonstrate that Israel is essentially at war with an enemy that it can never make peace with, however you want to, you know, assign blame for what's happened leading up to this point? You know, what can Israel do now and have any sort of confidence that it will be safe?
Yeah. It's for those who ask this question, I think it's important to look at history, recent history, and challenge the premise of the fact that if you give Palestinian freedom, they will turn against Israel. Israel has not done any whatsoever of a compromise since the beginning of when it was created. Everything that was offered to Palestinians is a fraction of what the international law grants Palestinians. And then to blame Palestinians for violence, for not getting what is our right, is where things, in my view, it's so unfair. How can you build peace if you don't give the other side or both sides same rights, same responsibilities, and treat them as equals? If you don't come to a solution that generates equality, don't expect anything but those who are oppressed to resist the oppressor. That's the nature of life. Palestinians were never offered a just peace. Never. The closest we were given is something in the Camp David, and it was not the full sovereignty over the 1967 borders. So why are Palestinians expected to accept anything less than what we deserve? Israel doesn't compromise when they give us a state that everyone accepts is our right as Palestinians. So my response is that, first of all, of course, I don't support violence, all forms of violence. But at the same time, if you continue to give Palestinians fractions and anything short of a just peace, anything short of what Palestinians deserve, our rights, we don't want anything beyond what the international law gives us, to be honest. If you give Palestinians, and you're not giving us something slightly less than that, you're giving us way less than that, then don't expect anything that human nature to reject oppression. Whenever someone is oppressed, that person or that people will reject and resist their oppression. That's the nature of life. And that's why talking about these issues, I know is very difficult for us Palestinians, because anything we say might come across as if we're justifying violence. And that's why I tried so hard in my book to help and plead with people, please understand the context. Palestinians don't wake up thinking, we hate the Jews, we want to destroy Israel. That's not the reality. Palestinians wake up thinking, how can we get rid of the gate or checkpoint outside of our village that's preventing us from moving freely? How can we enjoy the right of self-determination like everyone else? How can we help our refugees who still live in refugee camps since 1948 live in decent life, whether outside or come back to their towns and villages? Israel was created in 1948, and the creation of Israel created a mess for Palestinians. And since then, the world has never offered Palestinians anything even remotely close to a just peace, to a just solution, and then expect Palestinians to just accept, always compromise, and behave like, you know, saints and angels when they are oppressed, crushed, killed, and always put the blame on Palestinians. In fact, and this is where I'll answer this question finally, that's not the real question to ask, Cody. The real question to ask is, how can we now as Palestinians ever feel safe in this, in our own homeland? This is our land, by the way. You know, we didn't immigrate to here in 1948. We didn't come here based on an ancient promise that, you know, God gave to our ancestors. No, our ancestors lived here. We were born here. Our ancestors were born here. Our great, this is our land. And the real question now, can we ever be safe in our homeland, knowing that Israel just killed close to 100,000 of our people in Gaza, and knowing that they can do the same in the West Bank. The real question is about our safety, not the safety of our colonizers.
As you were talking about that, it made me, well, a couple of things came to mind. First was what we talked about earlier, that the first Intifada began under nonviolent circumstances. And then of course, October 7th, we see what happens over time when, you know, when Israel continues to not listen, to not want to have that conversation, to continue to oppress. But the other thing that came to mind is something that I think my libertarian listeners will see as something very significant to them, which is there was a debate in 2008, presidential debate for the Republican Party and in the United States. And there was Ron Paul, who's kind of the libertarian guy. And there was Rudy Giuliani, who was the mayor of New York during 9/11. And he, you know, every other word out of his mouth was 9/11. And you know, when asked about our foreign policy, Ron Paul said, you know, you need to listen to the reason that people, the reason that the terrorists attacked us, the reasons they're actually stating, and it's our foreign policy, that the CIA has this idea called blowback, that when you're engaging with your neighbors in a certain way, there can be consequences of that. And sometimes those consequences hurt innocent people. But so it becomes this, not necessarily the American civilians who died in the Twin Towers in 9/11, but their government has a responsibility for what happened on that day because of this idea of blowback. Is that kind of what you're getting at when you in your answer?
I think my thing is that if we continue to treat the issues basically as a simple black and white, evil versus good, without asking the difficult questions, why do they hate us? We're not going anywhere. And our experience as Palestinians, you know, you can't take October 7th as an isolated incident. That's what we're trying to say. None of that is me, for example, trying to say what happened was okay. No, I cannot accept. I must condemn killing civilians in their homes, definitely. But we must ask, how did that happen? Why did it happen? Let alone, by the way, Cody, you know, as a matter of a footnote, what actually happened, because how many soldiers were killed? How many of the soldiers were killed or of the Israeli civilians were killed by Israeli fire itself? No credible investigation has been published about what happened on October 7th. Yes, Hamas committed crimes, but other things happened on that day. What led to that day and all of these issues must be, but again, you know, we're not dealing with full transparency here when it comes to what happened on that day. But again, okay, Hamas killed many people. It was wrong. We must condemn it. But what led to that movement? And the more we continue to say, Palestinians, you know, wake up and decide we want to kill Jews, that's where the problem lies. And let me take it back to the story I told you about the woman and family that was attacked here near Ramallah by the settlers. And this is what when I tell the story to church leaders who come from the West to try to understand what's happening, this is what I tell them. I say, you know, when the son saw his mother literally being beaten on the ground, hit by a rock on her head, he took her to an intensive care unit. She spent 2 days there at least. And when he saw his mother on the ground in their land attacked by settlers, his instinct was to defend his mother.
Sure.
And he pushed the settlers out of the land. And they claimed that he attacked them, threw rocks at them. And no one was hurt from their side. But let's assume for the sake of argument that when he was defending his mother, he actually hurt one of the soldiers. Okay? Or, you know, harmed one of the settlers, not the soldiers, sorry. That he actually harmed one of the settlers. You know what will happen if he has done that? He will be called a terrorist. You will be telling us Israel has the right to defend itself. And that's what we have been shouting foul as Palestinians. Please understand the context. Don't treat Palestinian violence in isolation, let alone the idea that no one puts the Israeli violence in the same measure as they do with Palestinian violence, even though the Israeli violence is 100 times worse than the Palestinian violence. But I hope you get my idea that we need to ask the question, and we cannot treat incidents simply as isolated incidents.
You know, I always try to keep these at an hour, and I want to be respectful of your time. There's so many things that we could talk about. I think we should probably talk a little bit about the kind of biblical justifications for Zionism that some will not necessarily appeal to, you know, concerns of anti-Semitism, that, you know, the Jews need their own homeland or radical Islam or whatever. They'll look at scripture and they'll say, God gave the land to the Jewish people. That gift is irrevocable. And if we want to be blessed by God, we should side with Israel, even if they don't believe in Jesus. Many of them aren't even religiously observant, and they violate the basic rights of Palestinian Muslims and even Christians. And so, in other words, that this biblical obligation to defend the Jewish people if we want to be blessed outweigh the moral imperatives of the Sermon on the Mount, Paul's maxim that there's no longer Jew or Gentile, you know, basic natural law, secular morality.
You've said it all.
But in your books, like The Other Side of the Wall, you point out that the Old and New Testaments do point to this multi-ethnic kingdom where race doesn't matter, that the ultimate goal of the gospel of Jesus Christ is to bring the Gentiles into the people of God and make one family. And you highlight scriptures like Ezekiel 33, where Judah is chastised for thinking the land belongs to them absolutely, and God tells them that he's taking it away from them because they were so eager to use the sword against their neighbors. But your opponents might say, okay, yeah, sure, that's all in my scriptures. But when the ancient Hebrews first came into the land with Joshua, they did so by conquering and killing its inhabitants. And that holy war was sanctioned by God according to Torah because he'd promised them the land. And so why is the creation and maintenance of the modern state of Israel through bloodshed a different matter? Isn't modern Israel's occupation of Palestine really just an extension of God's command for Israel to possess the land, you know, 3,400 years ago?
You know, the whole interesting thing is that you're functioning under the assumption that the Israel of today is the continuation of the Israelite of the Bible and so on. And I must ask, under which basis? Is it ethnicity or is it religion or is it faith? It's much more complicated, guys. Please. Is it ethnicity? Does that mean God is a racist? Okay, God is a racist and God cares about DNA. Let's do a DNA test. You know, Palestinians, I'm willing to bet many of us had Jewish blood. You know, who knows? We converted. Who knows? We converted some from Judaism to Islam or from Judaism to Christianity. Does that even matter? Does God treat me based on my DNA? Come on, guys, we're ridiculous in these assumptions. Is it based on faith? So that if we believe in the Old Testament and the God of Israel, I believe in the Old Testament. I believe in the God of Israel. Abraham is my father. So again, you know, we make these assumptions and we separate one from the other. It's as if Christians, or let's talk about Middle Eastern Christians, have nothing to do with biblical Israel, even though most likely we are the continuation of biblical Israel, both physically and from a religious point of view. You know, we adopted the fact that Jesus is the Messiah of Israel, and that's how the church was created. So it's again, I want to challenge these naive, simplistic readings of history and the Bible that makes these correlations. But I want to make a distinction here, okay? Because we need to treat this question differently, whether we're talking as Christians or whether we're talking as Jews. So let me address the Jewish question first. I cannot deny, and I do not deny, the fact that Jews have always have an affinity and attachment to the land. That's their faith. That's their religion. I don't tell people what to believe. They always have this longing to Jerusalem, to the land, even in what they describe as the Jewish diaspora. That's fine. Again, our problem is when you translate that into a license to go and expel the people of the land and establish a national state on their land. When you translate into political right so that a Jew born in Brooklyn can immigrate to Palestine. It's their homeland now. And then they expel a Palestinian from Bethlehem who lives there and who can trace their lineage for hundreds of years, if not more. So that's why we have a problem. When you jump from a religious attachment into the language of political entitlement, that's Zionism. So that's where we have a problem. But then let's talk to the Christians. Christians who affirm these issues, I would say absolutely what you said. I would affirm that. I mean, who is our ethical standard? Is it the book of Joshua or the Sermon on the Mountain? What happened? You know, how does the coming of Christ change our understanding of the Old Testament promises, if it even impacts them? Should they impact them? And I would say in the end, you know, it shocks me that many Christians read the Old Testament as if Jesus never came, as if he never reconciled, you know, Jew and Gentile into one new community. That new community finds its roots in the Hebrew scripture and the promises to Abraham. Why else would Paul call Christians heirs according to the promise? In Christ, you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. In Christ, there is no Jew or Gentile. You know, this whole idea that I think Paul fought so hard, let's eliminate the distinction between Jew and Gentile. And now all of a sudden, Christian world that's saying, no, the Jews are distinct. We can't treat them as the same. So we're actually doing the exact opposite of what Paul was trying to do. And as I said, in the end, is the Bible the book that decides land deeds and decides who owns the land and based on what? So I wish, you know, people who say these things, come and have conversations with us. Let's have these deep and honest conversations. And I hope they understand the actual impact these conversations have on our livelihood. And I'm not trying again to dismiss these questions. Thank you for articulating what I've written in my books. We've written so hard on these issues. We've studied so hard. As you mentioned in the intro, my PhD thesis, which was published, is on the issue of the promised land. We take the Bible seriously. But on top of all, we take the teachings of Jesus seriously, the Sermon on the Mountain seriously. That's why when people ask me, how can you continue to promote nonviolence when you are oppressed, when your land is stolen, when you are humiliated on all levels? I say, Jesus said, love your enemy. That means I must resist the evil with good. So to me, I follow the Bible almost literally, but I prioritize the ethics of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mountain. And that's, I think, as Christians, that is the thing that should guide our ethics, our principles. And, you know, just as a side note, that's why we are horrified when we hear politicians quote the Bible these days in the United States to justify war and to justify violence. I mean, if you want to quote the Bible as a politician, fine, at least quote the Sermon on the Mountain. Mm-hmm. Don't quote these vengeance psalms or a Pulp Fiction thing, you know. So we take the Bible seriously. That's my point. We love the Bible. We take it seriously. But the Bible cannot be a platform, you know, the blueprint for war and genocide and a racist god of violence.
You wrote about a rare occasion when you were able to visit friends on the other side of the wall, and you saw your children play with their children. And you said, oh, I want to quote this. It was bittersweet to see our children playing together, despite the difficulties for them to communicate in Hebrew and Arabic. For a few hours, the occupier and occupied divide collapsed, at least in the innocence of children. It was only a glimpse of a possible better reality, a reality in which our children do not have to grow up in an environment where they will possibly find themselves in the very likely scenario where one stops and detains the other at a checkpoint, end quote. One might say that Palestinians and even to some extent Israelis are victims of systems like settler colonialism. And indeed, you do say that. But as I read what you said there, Ephesians 6:12 popped into my head. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, the authorities, the powers of this dark world, and the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. And I wondered, does your theology include a place for the demonic? And do you think that that partly explains what would drive human beings to dehumanize each other like we see happening in the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, spiritual forces exist, of course. I would just caution about, you know, saying certain people groups are demonic or so on. Definitely not. That's not the intention. And I definitely, the verse you quote, I definitely believe in, that there are forces in the world that work for evil. What concerns me more is our human responsibility, because these are the things that are within our realm. So we should pray, and we can and we should pray for divine intervention. We should, you know, guard and pray against evil forces. But we should also, I think more in terms of what we can do, what actions we can do, what is the impact of our words, of our actions, of our teachings, of our theologies. I'd like to think more in the realm of the things we control as human beings without neglecting the spiritual dimension, praying for sure, and making sure that we ground all of our activism in prayer. And I would like also to say, yes, we're all sinners, you know, by nature. We're all selfish by nature as human beings. We're all tribal by nature. That's why I talked about who's my neighbor, because we're more inclined in our selfish desires and our human desires to think of only the Palestinians as my neighbors, or even Palestinian Christians as my neighbor, or that mentality leads to me thinking only Palestinian evangelical Lutherans are my neighbors, and so on. So we are inclined in our nature to always think of ourselves, our human flesh desires, and we need to be cautious of that, especially when we are peacemakers, especially when we try to bring people together, especially when we talk about these issues that are so sensitive. You know, what's driving us? What's our motive? Something I always pray, Lord, sanctify our motives. Make sure your kingdom, your glory, not for any national ideological agenda that could, you know, that trumps our allegiance to the kingdom of God. As much as I love my land, as much as I love my people, as much as I take the, you know, I'm proud as I speak as a proud Palestinian, but at the end of the day, you know, I serve Christ and his agenda for our land, namely that of our world, justice, truth. And I hope you get what I'm saying, is that there are things that are also within our realm of control that we should make sure what we say and what we do actually, and consider the impact of these things.
Well, I want to be respectful of your time. We're a little over an hour. So Dr. Isaac, where can people find you and your work? And while you're talking about your work, can you also tell us about the Christ at the Checkpoint Conference and your work with Bethlehem Bible College?
Yeah. So thank you for that. You know, I encourage people to look us out on several issues, whether it's the Bethlehem Institute for Peace and Justice, my own podcast, Munder Isaac podcast, used to be called Christ at the Checkpoint. Now we're calling it the Munder Isaac podcast, but also Across the Divide podcast. We're trying to reach to the American Christian community with this message of Palestinian Christians. We run a conference in Bethlehem every 2 years called Christ at the Checkpoint. All the information, you'll find it on our pages. Just search Christ at the Checkpoint or Bethlehem Institute for Peace and Justice. It's an invitation for Christians around the world, especially American Christians, come and walk in our shoes. Come and walk in our streets. Come and enjoy our hospitality, our love, our compassion, but also come and experience life as we experience it. We usually hold it in May, but because of everything that's happening in our region, the war with Iran, we had to postpone it. We're hoping to have it December 27th to December 31st. So we're telling people, come and enjoy Christmas in Bethlehem. If you wish to celebrate Christmas, then attend the conference, or celebrate Christmas with your family and then fly to Bethlehem. What better place to be in other than Bethlehem in Christmas? But also look us in a conference called, we're doing a version of Christ at the Checkpoint now in the United States called The Church at the Crossroad. We've held one in Chicago last year. We're hoping to have another one in the Atlanta region this year, to be more precise, I think in November 5th to November 7th. Again, if you look us up in our social media or website, Bethlehem Institute for Peace and Justice or Christ at the Checkpoint, you'll find all these different information about the conferences that we have or the podcast that you can follow. Again, it's my podcast or Across the Divide, the Across the Divide podcast.
Dr. Isaac, I want to thank you so much for the work you do and for taking time to talk with me and my audience.
Thank you.
God bless.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.